they will not have a handout. I mean, you will have it online or virtually, but I want to have one in front of you. Okay. They're right here. So we were supposed to meet 2 weeks in a row, and due to the snowstorm, that did not happen. And I'd like to thank Kodesh Baruch Hu for organizing a snowstorm before Thursday and after Thursday, but not on Thursday, so we could finish this. Okay, do you remember the conversations that we had regarding the physiology and things of that nature, more or less? What? Somewhat more or less?
More or less.
Okay. All right. So I'd like to go through these sources with you to put that in context, and if we need to, we can remind ourselves about some of the physiology. It starts off, page 1 of 71, starts off with a Gemara and Baba Basra and Daf Yud. I don't remember if I did this with you or not. Did I do this with you? Okay. So the Gemara and Baba Basra, we're going to skip, and we'll start with the Shulchan Aruch then. I don't think I did that yet. Shulchan Aruch, Neven Ezra Simchav Gimel, speaks about the idea of the Issa Lahotzi Shivchazer Levatala. And the Shulchan Aruch speaks about the idea that not only is there an Isser, but there's an additional Isser that somebody who uses their hands to express sperm, there's an additional Isser, and that's found in Sif Bet. So the question is asked by the Zester of Moshe Feinstein, if somebody needs to do a sperm analysis, what's the best way to do a sperm analysis? Rav Moshe explains that the best way to do a sperm analysis is to do what we call the PCT, a post-coital test, namely the idea that after a husband has relations with his wife, they can look at the sperm within the vaginal area, remove the sperm in the vaginal area, and then check the sperm for morphology, again, for the structure of the sperm, and for the amount of sperm. But Rav Moshe acknowledges the fact that sometimes a doctor won't think that that's sufficient, because when you do a PCT test, as I showed you, there's a lot of other debris, human debris, if that's the proper word, or human other things within the vaginal area that will mask the ability to really see all parts of the sperm. And so therefore, what else can be done? And he speaks about the idea that perhaps he speaks about the fact that he doesn't want niyuf biyad, he doesn't want one to express sperm with their hand, and expresses the idea that maybe what could happen is and there's no isser, it's not considered moti shivchazer levatala from the perspective of that this is not shivchazer levatala because you're doing it in order to be able to have children. So he says that if you need to do some form of a bedika afterwards, if you need to do a bedika of the sperm, at least you can wear some type of what does it say here? Yeah, that some type, I just wanted to get the language. Either to put some type of metal thing, which doesn't really, not metal, glass. But he also speaks about using some form of a condom. So what's normally done is that to use a condom, now keep in mind, we're not talking about a standard condom, because a standard condom that you buy in a drugstore has spermicide in it. So if you're trying to check the sperm and you use a standard condom, you know, whatever you're trying to achieve by looking at the sperm, you've destroyed, because built into the condom is a spermicide. So you're talking about a special condom that the doctor would give out, the fertility specialist would give out, that doesn't have any spermicide as a part of it. And also, the tradition, at least in some places, is to put a hole on the side of the condom, not obviously on the front of the condom, because the sperm will spill out, but on the side of the condom to highlight that there's some form of derech via bakach. So if you want to follow Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Moshe Feinstein says that you can use some form of a condom. Rav Moshe has here this idea, that this is written many years ago, of waiting, it's Tavshin Chav Gimel, of waiting 5 years. That is not really something that's normally followed now, because where you live at a time in which if there are fertility challenges, which we defined as trying to have children for a year and unable to do so, that it doesn't really pay to wait an additional 4 years. And sometimes it actually can make things worse. For example, if a woman has fragile X, which means that she's carrying the recessive gene of fragile X, that sometimes, even though recessive genes don't normally affect the person carrying them, in this case, it actually can cause early menopause. Waiting 5 years is an eternity if you have a spouse that is not producing eggs or producing a limited amount of eggs because she's in a premature, what's called ovarian failure, or POF, which means the same thing, just the Rashi Tevos, a premature ovarian failure. So the bottom line is, in a case like that, I wouldn't even wait a year, I wouldn't wait a minute. I would actually speak to a fertility specialist right away to see, in that case, if there's a sperm challenge as well as an egg challenge, that's an example where there's a challenge on both sides. And if there's just an egg challenge, you can actually, as we talked about last time we met, about harvesting eggs. So, but Rav Moshe Feinstein is concerned, he dismisses the claim that this is Mochi Shifcha Zer Levatala, but is still concerned about expressing sperm with one's hand, and therefore suggests that another way is used. So sometimes, depending on the medical practice that it's doing, sometimes they'll use some form of ejaculation, in which they cause the ejaculation. Sometimes, again, it will... again, according to Rav Moshe, it's better for a husband and wife to have relations and cause the ejaculation of the sperm, but then the sperm needs to be delivered almost immediately to the lab. And sometimes you really need to be able to ejaculate the sperm moments before the doctors look at it, and therefore, in a standard situation, the ability to have relations... it becomes an impossibility. So you have the Tzitz Eliezer and others that discuss this, but the Tzitz Eliezer on the next page speaks about the idea that, first of all, if we've checked already for fertility challenges with the woman, that we've checked all the things that we talked about, that there isn't any types of tubal blockage, that there's not hormonal challenges, then the Rofe should be able to do a check of the man's sperm. This is, again, slightly different than a fertility specialist would normally do, but if you explain to him the fact that we're a little bit more concerned with expressing sperm, normally the OBGYN or the fertility specialist will recalibrate their tests to first check the woman for any abnormalities and then the husband. Then he explains then in number bet on page 2 of 71, the easiest way is to have relations with one's wife and then afterwards to express the sperm as you're leaving one's wife. And then he speaks about the idea of the concerns about PCT, which is in Gimel. Speaks about the ability to use a condom and Dalid. And then he speaks about the idea... and Vav, which is, I think, important, that if you can't do it in any other way, you can use your hands to express the sperm. Again, dismissing the statement in the Shulchan Aruch, because that Isser is when it's Motzi Shifcha Zer Levatala. Here it's not an issue of Motzi Shifcha Zer Levatala, but rather to do a Bedika in order to be able to have children. He speaks really in Zion, Kishimotzim Be'adayim Yesh Lahadiv Shicher Rofi Yasezo B'Kli Machshir, there's something called electric ejaculation where you actually can create an ejaculation of the to have the sperm. If that works, you can try to do that. And the in EF Shar Mutagam the Baal Ba'atzma Lasot Zot, that if the husband needs to create his own ejaculation, he should make sure that he's doing it l'shem shemayim, which obviously if he's going through such a process, he is, in order to fulfill the mitzvah of pruravu. And then he dismisses the idea that you have to wait a certain amount of time, but rather the idea that once we know that there is a fertility challenge, and we know that there is, it's not a female issue, but perhaps a male issue, that the ability to check sperm can be done right away. And that's the normative approach on these issues, and how we follow it. So that's the issue of testing for sperm. Then we talked about the idea of the fact that you can have multiple mothers, and you could have one father. And who is the father? Is it the father that's raising the child, paying those yeshiva tuitions every single month or year? Or is it the father or is the father the sperm donor? It seems from the sources that I'm going to share with you, the definition of a halachic father is the one who donates the gametes, namely the sperm. And that is found actually in a host of different places. Let's just run through it pretty fast. We're told in Megillas Esther about Esther, ke'en la av v'aim, she has no father or mother. And then it repeats it, ubamos aviha v'ima, lakha Mordechai lalavas. When her parents die, Mordechai takes her as a daughter. So the Talmud Bavli asks the question, why the need for the repetition in the same pasuk? And the Talmud Bavli explains that the mother died at the time of birth and the father died at the time of conception, to accentuate the fact that there was no interaction with the biological parents. And this seems to indicate, at least, that you're called parent. In this case, the father simply was a contributor of the sperm in the liaison that he had with his spouse. And the mother was the contributor of the genetic, of the gestational carrying, and that's the mother. And then you go to the Gemara in Chagigah and Daf Yudalad Amud Beis, where the Gemara in Chagigah and Daf Yudalad Amud Beis is asking to create a paradigmatic understanding of what the prohibition is with the Kohen. Is the prohibition of the Kohen Gadol, is he not allowed to marry somebody who has had Bia beforehand? Or even if the woman has never had Bia beforehand, but she's pregnant, does that possible for a Kohen Gadol? In other words, it's trying to search for what the din is. So the Gemara in Chagigah and Daf Yudalad Amud Beis asks, Basua she'ibra mahu l'kohen gadol. Someone who's never had relations but is pregnant, what's the status for a kohen gadol? Shmuel says that, you know, basically, if she's pregnant, she had a bia, even though she still has her dam psulim, you can figure out a way of doing that. And we say that Shmuel was not shriach, but yet there is the capacity for a woman to become pregnant without having relations. She can come pregnant from sperm within a bathhouse. Right. I'm not sure that this is medically correct. I'm pretty sure it's not medically correct. But again, I think the Gemara here is not trying to deal in the medical terms, but rather trying to pinpoint, to create a laser-sharp understanding of what the exact issue is with the Kohen Gadol. But this is a platform for a discussion regarding, in a case in which the man had no relations with the woman, but rather donated the sperm, is he the father? And the Beis Shmuel, or Shmuel Fivish, writes that he is the father, that the father, he's called the father l'chol davar, and explains that that's why we, he explains, shal tishkav al sadin sheshachav alehen ish acher, pentit raber mishivcha zera shal acher, gezerah shem yisa achoto. Me'aviv nishma dahavi beno l'chol davar. He explains that there's this idea that a woman should not sit on a bed that was used by another man, not her husband. Maybe the sperm will enter her and she will become pregnant. That act does not make her usher to her husband, because in order to be usher to the husband, as we'll see momentarily, you have to have intimacy, but it will create that she's pregnant and we won't know who the father is, and we're concerned that maybe a sister and a brother will marry each other. So the basic component that I'm trying to highlight is, Rav Shmuel Feivish already discusses the idea, sperm donor is father l'chol davar. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach in Noam, the first volume, not really a well-known periodical, but Rav Shlomo Zalman has a wonderful article in the first volume. Rav Shlomo Zalman therefore explains that in a case in which you need to do, he says a few things here. Number Aleph, he says that you can do IUI even in the time of Nida. This is a very important halacha. Sometimes you can create what's called an infertility that is unfortunately created by halachic norms. In other words, if a woman needs to wait after her Sheva Nikiyim 5 days, maybe she is already ovulating. And therefore, we try to postpone ovulation in different ways, sometimes through medications. Sometimes those medications can have a negative piece to it. It can cause multiple pregnancies. I'm not suggesting that having twins is a negative thing. I'm suggesting that it could be in certain cases, and definitely not if the couple doesn't want twins or can't handle twins. That's number one. The second thing is that you can create a situation in which, because she's waiting to go to the mikvah 5 days after the 7 days after the five, you can have a situation where her ovulation passes. And so therefore, there are different ways to deal with it, and one of them is inserting sperm within her fallopian tube, remember that tube where the pregnancy happens, during even the Sheva Nikiyim. Rav Shlomo Zalman is explaining that there's no problem with doing that. There's no issue of Zer Levatola. There's no problem that you know, we have this prohibition of a woman getting pregnant during the time of Nida. There isn't a concern about that. And also highlights the concern that he would never allow a Jewish male to donate sperm to a woman who the couple's having fertility problems, because he calls it a form of suffik mamzer, even though he says that hazra'ah in number gimel is not chashuva kiznut. If you don't have intimacy, sexual intimacy, inserting sperm of another married man is not considered znut. Nevertheless, it's not something that we support. And therefore, in a case in which you need to use foreign sperm, donor sperm, you should be using a non-Jew's donor sperm. That is Rav Shlomo Zalman. And Rav Moshe Feinstein also says the same thing. And Rav Moshe Feinstein actually was... I'm surprised I didn't put it in the source. Rav Moshe Feinstein actually is taken to task on this. No one ever yells at Rav Shlomo Zalman on this. I think it's because no one ever heard of the volume of Noam. But Rav Moshe gets killed twice on this. In fact, his house is firebombed by some crazy people who, I'm sure the Satmar Rebbe doesn't call them Hasidim, but they call themselves Hasidim of Satmar, because the Satmar Rebbe was not supportive of this approach. But Rav Moshe, in two different places in his tshuvas, speaks about the idea, when all else fails, you can use non-Jewish sperm. Yes?
How's that for Rishmu?
Because since Benohu L'chol Davar is a sperm donor, and there's no yichus regarding the father, you're not worried about Shema Yisa Basachoso if the sperm donor is a non-Jew. It's not a genetic concern, it's a different concern. Great question. Yes? Sorry?
Are there Tassar L'Vatala issues with sperm donation?
Well, first of all, I don't think there's any isser of a guy is mochi zifazer levatala. I don't think that Jews should be donating sperm because it creates all problems of yichus. You want to donate? No, that's what we studied earlier. That's the first two tshuvas, Rav Moshe on page 1 and the Tzitz Eliezer on page 2. There's no problem whatsoever with it because that's not considered.
That would be for the Baal.
The Baal.
Have that for other people also.
What do you mean?
Meaning if somebody wanted to donate to his next door neighbor's wife.
I don't think that anyone would be supportive of that. Because of all the concerns first of all, it's not your mitzvah that pre-revu. That's not a mitzvah of yours. That's number one. And number two, which I think is a greater issue, although number one is enough to stop the conversation, but number two, you'll create an issue of Shema Yisa Basachoso. You'll create Yichus challenges of great significance. We won't know who's whose father. Therefore, Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman are very strong in their comments that if you're going to use a sperm donor, it must be someone who's not Jewish. It mustn't be someone who is Jewish. Even though, as Rav Moshe says in a tshuva that for some reason I didn't put in here, maybe it's later on in the packet, he doesn't consider it tznus, and neither does Rav Shlomo Zalman consider it tznus. He's worried about the Shema Yisa Basachoso paradigm. I mean, can you imagine a sperm donor who's Jewish, who gives out sperm as an act of tzedakah to 25 different women who have fertility challenges? The Yichus challenges are going to be absurd and not ones that we would be able to handle with any ability. So they're very strong on that. Yes?
So what about the issue that the child has a non-Jewish father, which
is not Zer Yisrael? Okay, yeah, it's not Zer Yisrael. So the Rabbam has a whole thing on this. I remember the Rav giving a whole bunch of shiurim on this, but at the end of the day, I don't remember all the Briska Chakiras that he discussed, but at the end of the day, you can live without that. You can live with that issue. Okay? But it's the way to solve a significant dilemma. Okay? Okay. So, you know, if you turn to page 4 of 71, I wanted to show the Masoros HaShas, where Shmuel says that we're not choshesh, the v'chashinan, the idea of the Shmuel Oshchiach, v'chashinan Shem Ba'abati Ibra, and then you have Masoros HaShas and Rashi always saying that this idea that we think that you can get impregnated without having an intimate act is something that we paskin l'chumra and l'kula. I just thought it would be important to realize that. And if you turn to page 5 of 71, the Bach has something where he writes, Matzatzi b'hagos smag, Sefer Mitzvahs Katan, and it's not in the Sefer Mitzvahs Katan, it's a printing mistake, it's in the Sefer Mitzvahs Gadol, but Matzatzi b'hagos smag, Sefer Mitzvahs Gadol, that Shekasav Isha Nidash Yechola Lishkav Asedine Bala, we allow a woman to sit, even when she's a nida, on the bedsheets of her husband. But we're concerned about the fact that she would lie on the bedsheets of someone who, of another man, because we're afraid of, again, that she'll become pregnant with a sperm donation from the non-husband who's Jewish. Why aren't we concerned that she'll become pregnant with as a nida? We're not worried about any isser whatsoever. We're not worried about the kid being a ben nida accidentally. And then look at here. Even if she becomes pregnant from the sperm of somebody, another Jew, ki alo ben sisra kasher haya, ela the mashivcha zera shel ish acher kapdinan, we're machbid afchana gzeri shema yisa achosol me'aviv. We're worried about yichas issues. That's our major concern. So I wanted to just point that out. That is where both Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman get their opinion on the idea that was already asked about sperm donation by a Jew for another Jew, or sperm donation in general. If you turn to page 6, the idea of that's highlighted in the Taz of not having that if you get pregnant when you're a nida, that is, you know, you won't have children who are kadosh v'tar. And that's only a concern, again, I think if there's a sexual act, not if there's not a sexual act. And that brings us to the issue again that I reminded you of, that if there is infertility challenges caused by taras hamishpacha, God forbid, but it does happen, then impregnating the woman with sperm during those days of Shiva Nikiyam is good. And there's a whole idea about whether she should go to the mikveh beforehand or not. Because by going to the mikveh beforehand, as Rav Schechter mentioned in the Siyum, in a roundabout way, the idea is that you at least remove some status of Zava, after a few of the days. And therefore, when she gets pregnant, she's not, by going to the mikveh, it does not allow the husband and wife to resume any form of intimacy. But if, please God, she gets pregnant at that time, she's not a nida, a halachic, full halachic nida. So there are some who discuss the idea of going to the mikveh before you do an IUI, an intrauterine insemination, if that's possible. Another concern is that if you do an IUI, an intrauterine insemination, during the final days of nida, there might be a concern of poleta shivchazera. We have this idea of poleta shivchazera, that there's a minimum requirement of how many days to wait before you go to the mikveh? No? Rebbe Sai?
Depends if you're smart or ashman.
What?
Depends if you're smart or ashman.
Okay, so tell me what you think.
4 or 5
Mechaber Amon. 3, right?
Yeah, we add on, we have Chumrus.
Okay, so minimally it's 3. Okay? So the bottom line is, are you concerned about Palesha Shivchazera with IUI? So you have to speak to Poskim on that. Different Poskim, including different Rashi Yeshiva at YU, have different understandings of that issue. The Minhag of Rabbi Nachum Bershtin Shlita, who is the one that I have Kabbalah on these issues from, is that if there is the ability to wait 3 days after you do the IUI for the woman to go to the mikveh the second time to be able to then resume intimacy between husband and wife, you should try to do that. There are Rosh Yeshiva that I've had conversations with here who do not feel that there is poleta shivchazera, and some of the reason I believe for their opinion is simply because you're putting the sperm directly into the fallopian tube with not the concern that there'll be the backsplash out or something like that. But if you're interested in hearing what other Rosh Yeshiva feel about this, you're more than welcome to go ask them. But the bottom line is, there is an argument about this, but it's important to realize that if you're a rav in a community, before you tell a couple who's having fertility challenges to go to the mikveh, and therefore be yotze this chumra that she shouldn't be a nida when she becomes pregnant, understand that the couple has to be at the level that they understand that this going to the mikveh does not give them a license for intimacy. If you're concerned that by removing this chumra, you're going to create a kula that they're going to think they can be intimate with each other at a very difficult, challenging time within their lives, it's better not to be concerned about this chumra, which could result in having relations at a time in which they're not halachically permitted to do so at that time. So it is extremely important that you have to use your own discretion and judgment whether you tell somebody right before an IUI to go to the mikveh based on your knowledge of the couple and what you think the ramifications can be afterwards. Okay, the Tashbetz is basically saying similar things to already that I discussed. The Shulte Geborim here is actually the only one who brings down that maybe there is a pegima in a situation in which there is no sexual contact. It's mentioned by Rav Moshe Feinstein and others. This is why. Rav Moshe Feinstein's Shuvah is on source 9, on page 9. But Rav Moshe dismisses the Shilte Geborim and follows, as I've quoted to you, Makoros, which are easy to find when you read Rav Moshe Feinstein's Shuvah first. And that is the idea that in a case in which you need, the sperm of a non, if you need sperm, they should use the sperm of a non-Jew. And there's l'chein yesh lahatir b'shasat chak gadol mitzdarim ma'od b'hishtokikakam levlad, when they want to have a child, l'zrok li'isha b'meha zera shel nachri dafka. That's page 9 of 71. Mustamer sha'af stam zera yesh l'tlot shu shel nachra. You could assume that if you went to www.sperm.com, you know, unless the name, unless there's a name there, which I don't think there is from confidentiality, nor do, am I sure if that's a real website or not, but you can check yourself. But the bottom line is that, you know, where it's that the rove in America of sperm that you get from a sperm bank is of a nachri, and therefore you can use that. Okay? That's what he says. Okay. And that's what he is, and he's very concerned about a non-Jew, a Jew, giving sperm donations to others for the reasons you and I have already discussed. Okay? That's page 9 of 71 and page 10 of 71 where he has that tshuva. That's a really important tshuva. Again, there are two like this. Any questions? I'm just going through the stuff. We're good? I haven't lost anybody? We're good? Yes? Great question. Page 11 of 71. It says, the Minchas Allah, Minchas Yitzchak, wanted to use someone who everyone would consider not to be a modern Orthodox YU Rosh Yeshiva or whatever. I was just joking there. And that is the Minchas Yitzchak. Are you Yotzei Peru Revu? If you do these acts of... that's your question, right? And the Minchas Yitzchak says, definitely. All of the work that you have to do in order to be able to have children when you do IUI, intrauterine insemination, or IVF. He didn't say IVF because he wasn't around for IVF. But the bottom line is, the IUI, intrauterine insemination, and things of that nature, hishtadlus rav, it's a great amount of work. And therefore, there's no problem, it's therefore 100%. Look at page 13 of 71. Obenogeu nidan, im kiyim, mitzvazeh, mitzvah puruhu, shikurah chakru, bazeh gedoli achronim, v'nesabra v'ambati, v'chalkas mechokek, v'evan ezer, etc., 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 Pshita li dekayim mitzvah. He's quoting Beis Shmuel, but then he says himself, "Shiyish lomo lekayim lechuli alma mitzvah puruvu." The lo nesaber meila. This is not. There are many shitas that say if you sit in a bath and you get impregnated, that you yotze. But in this case, elanasa masa rav ishtablus gadol shitasaber. You've done all this hard work, and therefore I think it's definitely considered. Not only benolu l'chodavar, but you've been yotzei and came dvarav gam came pshita shekayim mitzvos piriyavi rivya. The other thing that I highlighted is in the Minchas Yitzchak is that when you do the IUI, he says he speaks about doing the IUI. That he permits you to do the IUI during the Shiva Nikiyam. Because there's no Isser Hazra'ah B'Shas Nidus. There's Man Nidus, and there's no Pagam to the baby if you do it. No spiritual Pagam to the baby that, to do it. Yes?
Is talking about Zeresh
Yisrael,
or
Zeresh Hanukkah? I assume, I think he was talking about Zeresh Yisrael.
Oh,
yeah. Zeresh Yisrael.
Only the man is
Zeresh Nachman. Right. Well, the woman is Mekayim in the mitzvah of Lishevish Yitzura. There's another mitzvah that the woman is Mekayim. Right. Right. So I think you're Mekayim other mitzvahs. Like, for example, you're Mekayim the mitzvah, you pay for the yeshiva education and other things of that nature. You become the father in different ways, in ways perhaps that more that count more than just being the, you know, the donor, the female gametes, the male gametes. You know, I would say that in a case like that where the father used non-Jewish sperm and the child knows no other father than the father who raised this child, man or woman, and then the father passes away, that the child sit shiva for the child, for the parent, that the child should sit shiva for the parent. Especially if he raised the, you know, especially if he or she was raised the whole time by this father. I'm sure there are various poskim that may say different things, but I think we, you know, if the father was a Kohen, this child would not be a Kohen. This child would be Yisrael, right? The father didn't donate the male gametes and he was a Kohen, the child would not be a Kohen. The child would still be Yisrael. Which brings us to something of PGD, pre-implementation genetic diagnosis. Remember we talked about PGD? We talked about the fact that you can create a situation where you have an egg that has been fertilized in a laboratory, and you can pull one cell from it at a certain stage in its development, and you can actually evaluate that cell to check if it's a if there are any genetic challenges or if the child is a boy or a girl, male or female. And if a father is a Kohen, sometimes the father will prefer that it's only female children that are returned to the womb of the mother, because he doesn't want to deal with all of the embarrassment that might come, especially in a place like Eretz Yisrael, where they duchen every single day, where the child will not duchen and the father will go up to duchen. It's almost an advertisement about the fact that it's not really his child. So you will see, especially in certain communities in Eretz Yisrael, even in the Haredi communities in Eretz Yisrael, that PGD will be done a lot in cases in which there is donor sperm as opposed to the sperm of the father himself. Do you understand what I just said? Understand why? Everyone get that? I'm not convinced by the faces. What? Okay. All right. So, the Note of Yehuda has an interesting thought on page... Rabbi, how much time do I have?
45 minutes.
Okay. The Note of Yehuda on page 15 has an interesting thought. And the Note of Yehuda asks the question... Did we do this Note of Yehuda last time?
No.
The Note of Yehuda asks the following question. Why do we say that when a husband passes away and the woman is childless, do you not wait not just 90 days, but 93 days? Because the whole idea of waiting 90 days is that you'll see whether she's pregnant or not. It takes 3 days sometimes for the sperm to be collate, for the sperm to fertilize the egg, which is a statement mentioned in the Gemara and has been proven by science to be a fully accurate statement. So why is it that you wait 90 days? You should wait 93. Most achronim say 90 days is a rounding number. 90 and 93, it's a rounding number. And Note of Yehuda says something unbelievable. And Note of Yehuda says that if when the husband dies, and let's say they had relations the day before, but the husband dies, the woman is not pregnant, even if she's pregnant 2 days later, she still has to go through the process of chalitza. That the Note of Yehuda says, ubein ein lo, the pasuk which says that there is no child, means at the moment of death, she's not pregnant. If she's pregnant 48 hours after death, she still needs to go through the process of yibum or chalitza. However, says Note of Yehuda, and this is the part that's important for us, when this child is born, even though she has to go through Yibum or Chalitza, you should just know, Ubenohu l'chol davar. It is the father's child in all areas. If the child, if the father was a Kohen, the child's a Kohen. If the father has Yerusha, the child would get the Yerusha. If the father has assets, the child would get the assets. This is a recognition of the fact that some learn from this Note of Yehuda something called posthumous paternity. If somebody has sperm in a sperm bank, because let's say they went off to war and they wanted to express sperm, or let's say they had certain cancer treatments and they wanted to express sperm beforehand, and Rahman al-Islam, they pass away, and then the wife is infused with this sperm, you can have something called posthumous paternity. So if the family already has 4 children, and now there's a 5th that is born, where the husband was not even alive, unlike in the story of Mordecai, where Esther's father died at the moment of conception, here is a case in which the father is not even alive at the moment of conception. The father died 10 years before, or 5 years before, or or a few months before. So there are those poskim that try to use the Note of Yehuda as proof to the fact that you can have the notion of posthumous paternity, that as long as you're a sperm donor, even if you're dead for 100 years, you can still be considered the father of a child. And he proves this from the, if you look at the last 3 lines of the Note of Yehuda on page 15, the Inkein Ani Omer, Isha Shalom Kolta Hazera, Kolta Nisas Bala, Amsha Kolta Achar Moso, Ubenohu Lahol Davar, Mikom Makom the Inyan Yibam Kvar Kmarinan Ba, Ubein Ein Lo Bashas Mesa, Ubas Yibam Hi. Then came Shaper Hayavama Mizyat Bemes, Achar Mises Bala Kimma Kadash. Just sums it all up in that one unbelievable sentence. So the Karana Ora on the next page actually says this is crazy. Page 16 of 71. How could that be? In the Yibu Koshiyesh Sofo Yoslo Zera Oshahayalov Akadak Mace Babar Yibumhu. You know, and isn't willing to accept anything of that nature. But in the Torah Shabbat, which is a volume, anyone ever see by show of hands Torah Shabbat? It's an unbelievable volume that's put out every single year. It must have like 50 plus volumes already on various contemporary halakhic issues put out by Musad HaRav Kook. If you ever are going to do any research on a topic, anything to do with Eretz Yisrael, anything to do with contemporary stuff, I'll bet you there's a volume of serious poskim who've written great articles on the Torah Shabbat Pet, and all you got to do is look at the index, and you're set with 10 articles, you know, within 15 minutes of doing the research. Okay? So in volume Lamed Gimel, there's a conversation here about this issue, and Rav Shaul Yisraeli actually quotes a group of Rabbanim who, in the Rabbanut, who paskin a case of posthumous paternity, that this child had the right to cause all of the assets of the father to be re-split. There was $1 million. Each one got $250,000 to four kids. He comes along. Everybody has to contribute so that now everyone only has $200,000, no longer just not a sweet $250,000, but I'm sure this brother or sister, brother, let's make it easy, this brother that they're all going to love because of the wonderful contribution they have to give upon his birth. He has to say Kaddish, Yartzai, yada, yada, yada. Rosh Hashanah Yisraeli, who was one of the poskim, major poskim of the past generation, he went ballistic. He says, you can't use this note of Yehuda to suggest that posthumous paternity creates paternity, because the note of Yehuda's case is significantly different. Our case of posthumous paternity is in a freezer somewhere is sperm. You have to unfreeze the sperm. Then you have to put it into the woman. The note of Yehuda's case is there's no other actions necessary by the human initiative. The husband and wife had relations. The husband died a day later. And now the sperm is naturally traveling along the process to be fertilizing the egg. And those of you in this case, Ubenohu L'chol Davar, is that at the point in which the father died, there's no more intervention by human beings. But in the case of posthumous paternity that we're talking about, there's still intervention. And therefore, there is, in other words, you have to take the sperm out of the freezer, you have to insert it within the woman. So this has not been answered. There are different people who say different things about posthumous paternity. Does it create a relationship with the father or not? It's still a conversation that's happening amongst the poskim. Just important for you to know. Yes?
While the father's alive, it's considered his kid and not going to hold the large, so then why is it a big deal if it's even after he's... If he's alive, it's going to be his kid, and then afterwards it's not.
Well, because at the point, who says the father still has the din of a father if his sperm donation happens after, is impregnating the woman after he's no longer in this world?
I know the father is defined by whoever
it
gives the sperm.
Right. So, the Rav Shaul Yisraeli would like to state that the definition is that he still has to be alive. If he's dead, he loses his the relationship between him and anything that he owns, including his own genetic material that's frozen somewhere, is no longer a thing, and therefore he has no father. Yes?
Let's say somebody gives sperm and dies the next day, and then some random lady he's never met takes a sperm 15 years later and has a kid, and then she finds out that he had an inheritance of $1 million and he gave his four kids. So would anybody say that child has a...
So if you read this article, Torah Shabbat Peh, it would seem that, I don't know what the halacha is, if she stole the sperm and stuff like that, that might play a role, but if the man gave her the sperm, according to Torah Shabbat Peh, this article, Torah Shabbat Peh.
But I'm saying, let's say he gave it to a bank, she just gets it from a bank, and finds out it's his. know, meaning it seems like a big difference, because in the noted Yehuda's case, this is his wife, he wants that relationship with his wife, he knows every single time he has a relationship with his wife, he might need to.
Right.
Here, he doesn't even necessarily know the lady.
Uh-huh.
I would think it's a bit different.
It could be, and I hear what you're saying. I mean, legally it's not really a possibility because sperm babes would never release. They could get sued by all of those children for releasing the identity, and they would land up having to pay for those assets as opposed to them coming. Part of the thing with sperm banks, that's why the Shem Yisrael Sokoso is, you can never find out who gave the sperm. Everything is done with an anonymity, and sperm banks that would compromise that would go out of business in a few moments. So I'm not sure it's a realistic, but I understand the question. My point of just bringing this up is, here are the cutting edge issues. Posthumous paternity is going to become a more cutting edge issue, not a less cutting edge issue. Is there a relationship between sperm and a father who's no longer living? Is there a relationship between somebody who is already buried and an asset that he has, namely his genetics, that's in a freezer somewhere? According to the Note of Yehuda, one can make the case that there is. And Bat Din in Eretz Yisrael have used that Note of Yehuda to agree with that. Rav Shaul Yisraeli, who was the head of the Sanhedrin, the major Beis Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim, vociferously agreed with that and made fun of these Rabbanim that when they signed their tshuva, they did not sign their names. And he said because it was such a flawed perspective, they didn't basically sign their names to the Rishon. I just wanted to give you that, just to realize that these are the issues that are going on. Yes?
You're close really with Holy as far as if he's a Kohen, the Aaron's child.
Sorry?
Through God to other Shabbos as well, not only just Yerushalayim, Kohen, everything.
Kohen, Tumatara, all the issues, 100%, yeah.
Not being a child.
Well, according to the Note of Yehuda, and according to those who use it, it would be. So you might say to Paschim Chumra that he shouldn't take the money from the other Yarshim, but he should. But if it's a male child and the sperm was from a Kohen, then he might have to be mocked on issues of Tumah Tahara. Maybe he wouldn't be a Kohen in the base of Mikdash. Maybe he should Tuchen. Again, we can discuss that with Poskim, but it's not a walk in the park to say that there's no relationship whatsoever. Even though Rav Shaul Yisraeli cuts it, there are many who say that cut isn't there, and they basically use the Note of Yehuda as the springboard for the conversation. Okay? Note of Yehuda contributes a lot to medical ethics issues, because he's the first one to speak about the whole notion also of doing autopsies to help save other people, and organ donations and things of that nature. He has tshuvas on that also. Okay. I just want to walk you through the next one, and that is that Tzitz Eliezer speaks about the whole notion of, speaks about the whole notion of, again, IVF and stuff like that. I point with an arrow on page 19 that he's totally supportive of the idea of having IUI during Mida time. And if you turn to page 20 of 71 and page 21 of 71, he was very concerned, Tzitz Eliezer was very conservative about the notion of any forms of fertility when you're using someone else's sperm and all those other things. It's very interesting because Tzitz Eliezer was opposed to Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, and Shaarei Tzedek Hospital has one of the most robust fertility clinics in all of Eretz Yisrael. So first of all, he highlights the idea that you can't use another man's sperm in a sperm donation, toiv gedola ra ad ma'od, and it might even be considered an issue of Isis ish, even though Rav Shlomo Zalman or Moshe said it wasn't an issue like that. He also speaks about his concern about whether it's a suffix mamzer, he speaks about the idea that someone who's born with an IVF or anything else of that nature, it's has been yotzei the mitzvah per revu. He says, you know, before you start doing issues of IUI, before you start doing things like IUI and stuff of that nature, you have to try to do everything else. We've discussed that. And here's the major issue I wanted to bring up with his, and that is that he says you need to make sure that there's hashgacha. I showed you in the first handout that we did that sometimes labs, as perfect as they can be, I'm not suggesting a lab that is nefarious and wants to do things that are not legal. But even the best labs, you can have a situation in which they can make mistakes. And therefore, the Tzitz Eliezer, as well as the most postum, I think if the only thing that you come out with is this issue, because you're going to be Rabbanim, is extremely important. And that is that people who go through these protocols, they should try to make sure there's hashgacha. A man expresses a sperm in a sperm lab, in a fertility clinic, who's making sure that his sperm is not getting mixed up with somebody else's sperm? They will tell you that they're only working with one person's sperm at a time. And that is normally correct. But when it's frozen, how do you make sure that it's labeled properly and that there is almost some, there's actually a way of the thing that holds the sperm in place to be locked in a way that only a third party can make sure that that proper sperm is being removed when that sperm is now going to be used to impregnate his wife. When eggs are being taken out, how do we make sure that those oocytes are not confused with somebody else's oocytes? These are issues that are extremely important, that there's a second set of eyes in the lab. It's not an easy thing. Labs don't like an additional set of eyes in their labs. So in the New York area, you're very fortunate that there are people who have been trained in the best labs to be that second set of eyes. And if you're abroad in the New York area, you can call Machon Pua, and they will send you somebody who's been trained to go to these labs that they've arranged for. In other places, like for example, in Boca Raton initially, there wasn't anyone who was trained, so we trained people to play those roles in Ashgacha, especially when you had so many young families, and by definition, which I know is discussed in other courses, there are always couples that are having challenges of having children, even though it looks like everybody's having children, there's always those few couples that cringe when the rabbi makes statements about how, indicating, how do we all deal with the issue of our children when they're struggling to be able to actualize the dream of having a family. So we don't want to add to their burden, but we want to make sure that there's a form of hashgacha. And that's what the Tzitz Eliezer is highlighting. On pages 23 through 34, I give you that article from Noam, because I'm not even sure the library has that article. And I thought for those of you who might want to learn the Sugya and the Rav Shlomo Zalman's conversations on it, you should have the whole article and not the piece I just cut out. So I decided to copy it. So page 23 through 34 is that piece. Okay? So now we move to the definition of maternity. How do we define who the mother is? And let me, before we go through the subject, let me just come to the conclusion, and then we'll back in to the conclusion by the Makorah. There are four different approaches within the posting. Two are minority opinions, meaning it's a random, they're out of the bell curve of normative psak. And that is, when you have two mothers, namely a host mother and a gestation and a donor of the gametes, that none of them are mothers because they're not both doing the whole job. And then you have those who say that both of them are mothers. We don't paskin like those approaches, but what there is a machlokus in the poskim, and the pendulum switches, is moving back and forth. I gave this shiur a few years ago. I would have said, and I think I did say, that most of the poskim, and including this was when Rebbe Yashu was still alive, let's say, I gave this shiur, it was recorded that Rebbe Yashu said that the definition of the mother is the gestational carrier, the one who is nurturing the fetus. However, the pendulum is moving. Even Rebbe Yashiv, prior to his passing away, had a conversation with the head dayan in London, saying that I have been quoted to saying, and I actually have permission to share with you that conversation, so I printed it in this handout that I'll show you. I was quoted that I said the definition of maternity is the gestational carrier. That was not an accurate quote, because even though I am not for this issue of using host mothers and things of that nature, I don't, you know, he's not sure he supports it, but he would, if he did, he would define the definition of motherhood to be the donor of the gametes, of the genetics, not the gestational carrier. People like Rav Aaron Soloveitchik have felt totally the opposite. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik writes that, hey, we have a sugya called that the first 40 days is not considered a fetus, the sac, it's considered what? First 40 days? No? Ma'ya la'alma. And actually, if you look at a book of gestational development, you'll see that at the 40th day, you start to see more human-like figures, characteristics. So this 40 days is not an arbitrary number. So, and the 40-day piece is an important component, and therefore why Ashkenazim used that in defining psichas kever, that psichas kever from an external psichas kever is actually, has to be the size, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, of two fingers, or 3/4 of an inch, because according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, psichas kever has to be when the vlad is at least 40 days old, and that's the width of the vlad at 40 days old. The Sephardim paskin that you just needed a very, you know, the Sephardim were paskin that the example, I remember when I studied with Rav Mordechai Eliyahu Zatzal, the language he used was, if you want to understand how Sephardim and paskin on this issue, then he said, even the refill of a Parker pen. I don't know if anyone's ever seen a Parker pen anymore. Have you seen it? Very early, I see it, but I'm not sure anyone else in this room. It says, even the refill of a Parker pen, if there's that much psicha, Sfarim would say that that's considered psicha's kever. I remember one of the Bechina questions he gave me, and the oral Bechina was, what's the difference between Sfarim and Ashkenazim and issues of psicha's kever? And I explained the differences. I didn't know the terminology of the refill of a Parker pen, but the bottom line is there's differences. Getting back to the point that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik says, who's the mother in day 41? In day 41, the person who gave the genetics is no longer around. In day 41, it's only the gestational carrier. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik says, look at the genetic donor as nothing different than the donation coming from Japan, his words. Made in Japan, the person who gave the egg. It's not around in day 41, therefore it doesn't play a role in the definition of maternity. Rav Zalman Lechenya Goldberg also says definition of mother is the gestational carrier who's nurturing the fetus. Rav Mordechai Willi Shlita says it's the genetic donor who is the mother of this child. And so therefore the point is there are multiple poskim who say different things on this issue, and therefore we have to be very careful. And therefore, Rav Zalman Lechemia Goldberg, in the fifth volume of Chumen, writes an unbelievable thing, that is that even though I feel that the definition of maternity is the gestational carrier, if one of the two mothers is not Jewish, you should do Geirus Misafek. Because you don't want to create a situation where this baby is only kosher to this Shita and not kosher to this Shita. Well, it's bad enough that, you know, we have, that this restaurant's only kosher according to this shita, this restaurant's only kosher according to this shita. We don't want children to become like restaurants, that if you, you know, you follow a certain hashgacha, you can go with that restaurant. You don't follow a certain hashgacha, you can't go with that restaurant. We want all children to be yotze according to all the shitas. So therefore, Rav Zalman Lechemia Goldberg, and I follow this, and I encourage others that if one of the two mothers isn't Jewish, they do Geirus Misafek. And then in 20 years from now, they'll decide if the Geirus was necessary or not, but this way you basically have covered all your bases. Because in 20 years from now, you don't know whether that child's is firm enough to, if they need Geirus, to be able to go through the protocols of Geirus. And therefore, in the case where one of the fetus and one of the mothers isn't Jewish, you should do Geirus Misafek. If we look at the various different if we look at the hand that I've given you, you'll see Rav Shol Yisraeli, in a letter to Rav Menachem Pershti, writes the definition of maternity is the gestational carrier. He gives a mudna proof. His proof is a aganita in the Targum Yonatan, where the Targum Yonatan explains that when Rachel gave birth to Dinah, that Rachel realized actually that in her womb was Yosef, and, excuse me, when Leah gave birth to, Leah realized that in her womb was Yosef, and in the womb of, in the womb of Rachel was Dinah. And Leah prayed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that her sister Rachel should have at least as many male children as the Shvachos have. If you look at the Targum Yonatan and Bereishis, what I have from you, the Hislapu or Baya, the Mahon, and the fetuses, that Hashem listened to the prayer of Leah, and the fetuses were switched. It was an interuterine exchange. The Hava Yahav Yosef b'ma'asa de Rachel, b'dina b'ma'aha de Leah. And in the womb of Rachel was Yosef, and became Yosef, and the womb of Leah became Dinah. There was an exchange. Rav Shol Yisraeli uses this Agadita. Again, it's a Madna thing that he uses Agadita. He uses the Agadita to prove the point that the definition of maternity is the gestational carrier. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik says, not for the same reason, but for the reason I just told you, and that is that it's Maya Ba'alma. And therefore, you can see in the final lines of the sixth line from the beginning of his quote, he says that it's like, view the egg as a synthetic material to Tseret Yapan, made in Japan. L'chein v'lad ha'novag l'Yisraelis mitruma beitzit chogaya ein tzarech geirus afilu l'chomer. That if the egg came from a non-Jew, that's not a concern whatsoever. The Nishmas Avram and Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Rav Zalman Lechemi Goldberg also says, he bases it on Gemara and Yavamas, but the Gemara and Yavamas says that if you were, that if you have a cake of Horasam Shalom B'Kedusha, Veleda Sam B'Kedusha, Lo Choltzim B'Lo Miyavnim, Avo Chayvim Mishum Esashah. He says that you see that if a woman who's pregnant goes through Geirus, that there is a cutting off the fetuses and the relationship they have with their father is cut. That's why there's no chalitza and no yibum, but the relationship that they have the relationship that they have that is defined through the mother still continues. That's why they're chayav and mishum eishas ach. So what does Rav Zalman Lechemi Goldberg say from here? You see that the definition of motherhood is not at the moment of conception like it is with the father, but rather throughout the gestational period. And therefore, based on this Gemara and Yavamas, Rav Zalman Lechemi Goldberg says the definition of maternity isn't the genetic donation, or else the relationship between the fetuses and the mother would also be cut at the moment of Geirus when she's pregnant, like it is to the father. And therefore, since we don't see that, it must be the gestational development is the definitive component. And therefore, he holds that it's the surrogate mother, the gestational carrier, that's the mother. In the Nishmas Avram, Rav Yashiv is quoted on this issue, and they quote Rav Yashiv as saying that while he's not so happy with this whole thing, but he also says the gestational carrier is the mother. He says, I heard from Rav Yashiv this and this and this, says the Nishmas Avram. However, if you look at a conversation of, let's turn to page 38, it's a conversation between Rav Dayan Arentrau and Rav Yashiv. Dayan Arentrau was a major Dayan in Europe. Rav Dayan Arentrau says that even though that Rav Yashiv told him, it's a conversation, you can read the whole thing, but the bottom line is that if you flip to page 39 of 71, where I have the three asterisks and the two asterisks, he says that his definition of paternity is not the gestational carrier, but no different than the father, the donor of the genetics. And he says, even though I was quoted by Professor Sofer and Nishmat Avram, that is the Isha Hayoledes is the aim, Harav lo iskim l'kach, that he didn't agree to this, but rather it is not the pundikayet, which means the gestational carrier, but rather the genetic donor that is the father of all the father, that is the mother of the child. On page 40 of 71 and page 41 of 71, I just show you why hashgacha is so important. Here is an example in which you have fetuses that were mixed up. So there's a fertility clinic that tells the couple, I'm sorry, you got the wrong embryo. So, and that's, again, not a mistake. It is, it's a mistake, not an on-purpose mistake, but a mistake. Therefore, hashgacha is so important. So we have 15 minutes left. In the 15 minutes we have left, I'd like to focus on two other things with you, and that is PGD, pre-implementation genetic diagnosis. That can be done to deal with a whole bunch of genetic anomalies. So if a husband and wife are carriers, if the husband and wife are carriers, and they're afraid, let's say, the child's going to get Tay-Sachs, you can do PGD where the egg is fertilized in the lab, and after the blastocyst stage of development, you pull one cell away, you look at that one cell, and you have an encyclopedic view into everything about the child that is genetics. What color hair the child's going to have, what color eyes, male, female, as well as any genetic anomalies. So are you permitted to use PGD? And here we see there's several different letters that I share with you. That some, like for example, the author of the Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa was concerned about PGD being used because he says it crosses the line of us not being HaKadosh Baruch Hu's junior partners but acting like God. But he actually then retreats a little bit from his statement, which we'll see. But most poskim, the vast majority of poskim, say that to use PGD in order to be able to make sure that the child has no genetic anomalies is 100% okay. So let's say you have a woman who has the Fragile X syndrome, and I use the Fragile X syndrome a lot in these examples. First of all, it's a lot on my mind because I've been asked a lot of questions about Fragile X in the past few weeks. And second of all, it's on my mind, maybe very early before we put it up, we'll take this line out, because there are certain places that do genetic testing that don't check for Fragile X because they feel it's not a shidduch breaker, which maybe is, maybe it's not, whatever. The bottom line is, if a woman doesn't know she has Fragile X, yeah, she can have a child, and the child, depending if it's male or female, will have a certain level of retardation and other challenges depending on the repetitions of the Fragile X. But the biggest concern that could be is, and it doesn't have to be a shidduch breaker, but it should be informed, that if a woman is carrying Fragile X, she can go into premature menopause. She goes into premature menopause. Instead of being able to have children until she's 45, she might not be able to have children. She might only be able to have children until she's 32 or 33. And if she knows she has Fragile X, then it pays to freeze a whole bunch of eggs so that she can have children for many years afterwards. But if she doesn't know that because someone decided that that is not a shit-up breaker in closed testing, they have basically condemned this couple to having maybe one child and nothing more, or two children, depending on when they got married. So PGD can allow somebody who, let's say, has a Fragile X issue to be able to do IVF followed by PGD, and then only return children who don't have the Fragile X syndrome into the womb of the mother, future children, embryos. And therefore, again, PGD can help save us with a lot of genetic challenges. Most poskim totally celebrate that. So, for example, you have on page 43 of 71, you have Rav Shlomo Zalman, who was not alive at the time of PGD, but explains that in order to make sure that a child doesn't have hemophilia, you can do different things like a sperm wash or things of that nature. But normally, look at line 27 that I wrote, "Bahadei kvasei derachmana lamaleich." We don't normally tread in the fields of God, But when we can do some type of procedure that can make sure that the fetus does not have genetic anomalies, Rav Shlomo Zalman permitted it and encouraged it. Rav Menachem Bershtein, on page 44 of 71, asked about PGD in cases of genetics and other things of that nature, page 44 of 71, and he got various answers. So Rav Nebensal, on page 45, speaks about it. Not much about it. Rav Amar speaks about it and says that for Tzorach Rufua, he permits it. Page 45 of 71. Page 46 of 71, Rav Nordvik was very concerned about PGD. It bothers me that you're involved in these type of things. That's not our job. But then he says, however, look at Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach that basically permitted it. So he's not happy with it, but he acknowledges that Rav Shlomo Zalman permitted it, and therefore he can't totally say that he's against it. Rav Yaakov Ariel has a tshuva on this. Again, you can just read these yourself if you don't need me. But and then you have from one of the great Sephardic poskim, you have on page 48, where if it's to stop genetic anomalies, it's permitted. There's an article that I wrote on this issue in Tradition, page 49 through 60. You can read that on your own. Then there's another article that I wrote on gynecological procedures and their interface with halacha. Because a lot of times we start defining women as nida when they're not. And the Journal of Contemporary Halacha actually forgot to include one footnote here that needs to be mentioned, and that is that Rav Schechter was kind enough to go through the article with me before I published it. I forgot the first footnote. And we go to page 70 and page 71, and here I'll just do this outside, and that is that we now, that is about oocyte cryopreservation, the idea of freezing eggs. So the egg, of the trillions of cells in the body, the egg is the largest cell in the body. And by it being the largest cell, its ability to be to go through a freezing process of like 98 degrees to negative, I think it's 350 or 400 degrees, is very hard without the egg being compromised. There is a form of freezing that takes around 1 second called vitrification that allows you to freeze an egg in a second that does not compromise the egg itself. And that process started around 2 years ago. So now you have a situation where you can freeze eggs. So in a conversation that Rav Usher Weiss Shlita had, Rav Menachem Bershtein Shlita had, with Yivado Mechaim L'chaim Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal, they came to the conclusion, and this is not yet written up, but I verified it with Rav Menachem Bershtein. They came to the conclusion that they would support the freezing of eggs in several different cases. Case number one. Let's say a woman is getting to the point where she's an older single and she's afraid that she hasn't met the right guy yet, and what's going to happen is that she's going to be forced, if she wants to have a child, to use donor sperm and to become a single parent, which sometimes happens to become a single parent, you know, but it's not something that we want women to be automatically by default becoming single parents. Or she's going to marry someone she doesn't really feel that she can live a life with, but she has no choice. So in those cases, they felt that you should freeze eggs. You can freeze eggs in your late 20s, early 30s. And then basically that glass ceiling of menopause starting at a point where you might not be able to have children is postponed, because you'll still be able to have your genetic eggs in a freezer somewhere, and therefore you can take them out. Let's say a woman is going through cancer treatments, Rahmana Litzlan, and they're afraid that the cancer treatments are going to affect her ability to have children in the future because the cancer might affect the ovaries where all the eggs are. A woman doesn't have, unlike a man with sperm, where sometimes the sperm reproduces, a woman has a certain amount of eggs and that's it. So in that case, if we can postpone the cancer treatments for a little amount of time, for a month or so, to harvest eggs, we would try to do that. Let's say a woman has the BRCA gene, and the doctor says, listen, your family history shows you might get cancer. It's important that you have your ovaries removed in order to save yourself from having getting cancer and dying. So if you can postpone having the ovaries removed for a few months and then harvest eggs, you can fertilize, you can freeze those eggs, and then she can still have, in the future, children with their own genetic eggs. So those are all cases where we would fully support this new oocyte cryopreservation, this new form of harvesting eggs. Any questions on that? Everyone understand that? Any questions on any of this? So we're walking apart? We're good? Okay. So let me add with one more thing, and then we'll conclude. A few months ago, as I showed you in the thing, there was this whole notion about the fact that the egg, the nucleus of the egg, has around 20,000 genetic codes, and the mitochondrial DNA has around 37 genetic codes. You can now switch out the mitochondria of the egg to put somebody else's mitochondria in case the mitochondria has certain genetic challenges to it. Egg that has mitochondria dysfunction, since the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell, can create a situation in which that in a child, the parts of the body which require the most amount of energy, like the heart and things of that nature, can be weakened if the mitochondria in the genetic development is weak. So the question then becomes, how do you deal with a child that has three mothers? Mother number one is the nucleus of the egg. Mother number two is the mitochondrial DNA of the egg. Mother number three can be the gestational carrier. So if you hold that the definition of the mother is genetics, now you have two mothers, the mitochondrial DNA mother, and the nucleus mother, and then you have the gestational carrier. So this, again, is only a few months old, unlike egg freezing, which is old, meaning it's 40 months old. This is only 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months old. I don't remember the exact date. I gave you this stuff last time. And again, no one's written on this yet. This is stuff that's yet to be written on. I'm actually working on an article tradition on this. But the bottom line is, I think that in a case in which, if you side with the perspective that it's just the genetics, I think it would be safe to say that since the vast majority of the genetics, 20,000 genetic pieces are found in a nucleus, 37 are found in the mitochondrial DNA, it might be fair to say that you follow the row of the genetics where the 20,000 is, and the mother of the nucleus is the genetic mother, not the mother of the mitochondrial DNA. But this is a now conversation. It will become more complicated in a few years, and I might just show one of you will be giving classes like this. And that is when it will be that you will be able to cut and paste pieces of the 20,000 splicing of the genetics, when you won't have just, you know, the layup question, which is only two genetic mothers, but rather you can have a finite amount of genetic mothers, but it could be 5, 6, 7, or 8, then the real work will begin on this topic. Yes?
I was just going to say, is there a possibility to raise about a person having two mothers in the sense, like, you show me says Bygolius, right, that he had multiple fathers because the assumption that they mixed in the genetic material, so someone could possibly that the person has two mothers?
Yeah, I said earlier that there are some teachers that say that in the case of when you have a genetic mother and gestational carrier, there's one sheet that says you have two mothers, but no one, that sheet that never took off. In other words, you
there's more of a bifurcation going
yeah.
after two different
right.
So here it could
right.
be it's more of a yeah.
I don't know. It's up for conversation.
Well, that's
okay.
Nothing here right now.
Simon is.
I forgot his sign. Sure. Sorry. Wait, forgot one? I forgot the sign. It's okay.
Okay, Michael.
I mentioned that.
I'm going to have this roll.